With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, efforts to highlight ag as part of the solution for endangered species. But our top story today, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has just launched the latest in a series of projects designed to expand consumer access to healthy foods. Gary Crawford has more.
Most of us can easily go to our local supermarket and find just about any fresh and healthful food that there is. But in this country today, there are still places where people don't have easy access to fresh, healthy foods, such as fruits and vegetables. However, there is a lot of work going on to change that, work that will also help the farmers who grow those foods. The latest development coming this past week in an announcement from Deputy Agriculture Secretary Social Torres-Small, who told reporters,
USDA Rural Development and the Reinvestment Fund are announcing the selection of 16 partnerships that will receive more than $40 million in grants under the Healthy Food Financing Initiative Partnerships Program to expand access to nutritious and affordable foods in 20 states and in Washington, D.C.
Grants will be used by local organizations to do such things as establishing new local markets and local supply chains and helping local food retailers to offer more fresh produce for their customers. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says this is just part of a huge effort to give consumers more access to healthful foods and to give local farmers more access to nearby markets, an effort that includes
establishing regional food business centers, investing over $300 million in local agricultural marketing initiatives, establishing resources in partnership with states, nearly $700 million invested in states under our regional food system infrastructure effort. We've had local food purchasing agreements where we're creating the opportunity for local opportunities for schools, for food banks to basically sell to a small and mid-sized producer in the region, in the locality, as opposed to a large-scale distributors. We're creating farm-to-school commitments across the board. And finally, we've essentially invested billions of dollars in our procurement efforts as we try to deal with the issue of dealing with food insecurity, encouraging those resources that are going into food banks to come from as much as they can from local and regional food producers.
So people who live in some of the most remote parts of the country don't have to travel so far from home to find fresh, healthy food.
And farmers don't have to ship their products hundreds of miles just to find buyers for those crops. Economists say that our farmers get a much bigger percentage of each dollar that we consumers spend on food when that food is marketed right there in the local area where it's produced. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA's Rural Development Mission area goes beyond rural economic development as aspects also contribute to addressing climate issues. Here's Rod Bain.
When it comes to environmental protection and conservation aspects of our planet and its natural resources in the context of the Agriculture Department, one may not be aware that the Rural Development Mission area plays a role. After all, like the name indicates, rural development suggests economic development and growth within rural communities and areas. But as Rural Development, Rural Business Cooperative Services Administrator Betsy Dirksen-Londegren points out, the RD Mission area is also invested in improving climate along with rural economies. For instance,
our Rural Energy for America program, which is for ag producers and rural businesses to invest in renewable energy systems or do energy efficiency upgrades.
Rural Development Undersecretary Basil Gooden provides an example of how use of REAP offers benefits both economically and environmentally. In the case of one business entity,
he was able to reinvest in his company to actually provide additional insurance, vision and dental insurance, and provide extra time off. So it didn't really reduce the need for his workforce. It was actually quite the contrary. He was able to invest more in his workforce.
Then there is the Higher Blends Infrastructure Incentives Program.
This particular program is to do things like upgrade pumps, fuel dispensers, and other equipment that will increase the availability of biofuels at fueling stations and distribution facilities across the country.
With farm and forest producers growing various feedstocks for biofuel development, Administrator Dirksen Londegren adds growers and landowners see opportunities regarding climate mitigation and commodity production through USDA's BioPreferred labeling program.
This is our label for bio-based products. And as we move into this reindustrialization around the bioeconomy, programs like the BioPreferred program help consumers understand when they see that stamp that it is a certified bio-based product.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's national spotlight, Midwest Dairy represents 4,000 dairy farm families and works to build dairy demand, critical work that requires strong leadership. Chad Smith has more on the new leader.
Corey Scott is the new CEO of Midwest Dairy, who began her duties in March.
The first few weeks have been an absolute whirlwind of meeting the staff, meeting all of our board. We just concluded our annual meeting last week, so I had the opportunity to meet all 120 corporate board members and division board members for Midwest Dairy and really be thrown in headfirst to what the organization values and some of our strategic focus for the year going forward.
Scott talks about how her previous experience prepared her for the job.
I have been in food and beverage and food and agriculture for just over 15 years. So I had the unique opportunity to start in agronomy by working for a local cooperative and driving a semi-truck, and then had the opportunity to move into Land O'Lakes, a cooperative based right here in Minnesota that supports just over 1,000 dairy producers. When I did transition into dairy, I spent quite a lot of time working on farm in risk management and on-farm consulting. So I led a team of on-farm consultants that focused on the business objectives of dairy farmers. I then had the opportunity to transition into more of a sustainability-focused role. And this role is a little bit unique and really has made up the last 3 years of my career. I really was working to be the bridge between farmers doing great things at the farm gate and the multinational companies and the consumers that care about those activities and the impact that they have on the environment.
Scott talks about her top priorities as the new CEO.
First, in order to increase dairy consumption, we have to build trust in dairy. And so you're going to see Midwest Dairy do a lot of work in understanding what our consumer-based trust levels are. We already know that there's a huge opportunity in Gen Z to build more trust. So you're going to see us focus some efforts in building that trust before that Gen Z becomes the next spending power. There's also unique categories of thought leaders where we need to build more trust, and sustainability thought leaders is one of those. The second piece to building trust and increasing consumption is ensuring that we have the products that meet the interests and the goals of those consumers that we're trying to reach. You already heard me talk about Gen Z. What they're seeking in dairy products is very different than what my grandparents are seeking in dairy products.
She says Midwest Dairy will also focus on research and innovation in the dairy sector. Scott talks about her vision for the future of Midwest Dairy.
When I'm speaking with farmers, one of the things that I want to emphasize is the power that their voice has. So when I think about the future of Midwest Dairy and the farmers that are in it, I want our farmers to know that they have incredible power by sharing their stories. When we go speak with consumers in our population centers, many, many of these individuals have never seen a cow, much less touched them or had the opportunity to even speak with a farmer. In the day and time that we exist in today, have a unique opportunity to engage on a different level, and that's through digital media.
To learn more about Corey and the other Midwest Dairy leaders and see the Dairy Checkoff at work, visit MidwestDairy.com. Chad Smith reporting.
The first of several USDA-led regional food business centers is now in business and accepting grant applications to help small and mid-sized farm and food businesses to grow. Rod Bain has more.
It is the first of 12 regional food business centers developed by the Agriculture Department, covering Minnesota and the Dakotas. And recently, the North Central Regional Food Business Center announced business builder grant availability to assist small and mid-sized farm and food businesses with a regional focus. Felicity Merritt is with the North Central Center.
For the applicants in our region, applications are open right now and they are due April 30th.
Grants through the Agricultural Marketing Service support regional food business centers in expanding supply chain technical assistance and regional marketing and sales opportunities. Some awards in the North Central Center's coverage area will be given annually for the next 5 years. Similar food business centers include one national in scope for intertribal farm and food businesses. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's John Harith with the Livestock Report.
Lower beef production and tighter beef supplies represent a challenge for U.S. exporters, but U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom explains that with support from USDA and the Beef Checkoff Program, USMEF is finding new opportunities for underutilized cuts in a wide range of international markets. These efforts, along with marketing of beef variety meats, help maximize the value of every animal.
The performance on beef was, I think, a pretty good sign, because we all know production's down, will remain down for the foreseeable future. But this is really an opportunity for the industry and for USMEF in particular to work on maximizing the value of that carcass and really focusing in on some of the subprimals that might be underperforming. And we've had quite a bit of success on the different cuts within the round primal. Knuckles, insides, et cetera, outside round flats, a lot of success there in places like Taiwan, Korea, even in Mexico and Central America. We've seen some success on some of these cuts. Shoulder clods, another area of the carcass. And of course, you can't forget variety meats. Variety meats continue to be a very important part of the growth. We've got markets like Mexico showing growth. You have the Middle East and Korea and South America as well, and even the Caribbean. So our overall goal is to diversify into as many markets as possible. And in the case of variety meats, it's really a testament to the fact that it is working.
Hallstrom adds that expanded opportunities for underutilized cuts will endure even as U.S. beef production rebounds in the future.
I think this is the silver lining with production down significantly last year and again this year. It gives us an opportunity to really focus in and maximize the value of that carcass outside of the normal mix that a lot of these countries may buy.
I'm John Harith.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has finalized Endangered Species Act revisions to improve participation in its voluntary conservation programs. Previous Almond Alliance CEO Aubrey Betancourt explained the value of conservation benefit agreements.
These are contracts that groups of landowners can engage in with the government to give them protection under the law, under the Endangered Species Act, as they contribute to solutions for endangered species. This is something we've been exploring with regards to monarch butterfly, as well as native pollinators in California. So it's really important that these tools continue to be developed and acknowledged as these new rulemakings are taking place. For us as farmers, we want to also maintain our plant health tools and a number of other mechanisms. But I think we have a really good opportunity here to demand respect and assurances and partnership for the good work that we do, and that it actually contributes to the very solutions and the outcomes that the regulations are trying to develop.
Nutrien Ag Solutions has pledged nearly $850,000 over 3 years to the National FFA organization as part of their ongoing commitment to cultivating future leaders in agriculture. The yearly donation of more than $282,000 will fund various FFA programs and events, including advisor development, scholarships for FFA officers, and alumni chapter grants. Molly Ball, president of the National FFA Foundation, expressed gratitude for Nutrien's consistent support, highlighting the impact on member development and advisor support. Spencer Harris, senior vice president at Nutrien and an FFA alum, emphasized the organization's enduring partnership and the importance of FFA in nurturing agricultural talent. The National FFA organization supports the leadership development of more than 945,000 members through more than 9,100 local FFA chapters. A recent report from the Institute of Agriculture and Trade Policy highlights concerns with the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. The report suggests that expensive practices with limited conservation benefits received significant funding through EQIP, while two-thirds of farmer applicants were rejected in 2023. IATP contends that reforms to EQIP can better serve farmers and enhance climate resilience. Recommendations from the report include removing costly practices, which purportedly favor large-scale farms, reducing payment limits to increase farmer access, and integrating additional funding sources beyond 2031. The report emphasizes prioritizing cost-effective conservation practices and advocates for transitioning farmers towards more comprehensive approaches like the Conservation Stewardship Program. By addressing these issues, IATP believes that EQIP can become a more effective tool for promoting sustainable agriculture. Industry groups are asking questions about why water fees are continuing to increase. President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association, Roger Isom, said they're looking for more oversight of the State Water Resources Control Board.
We're increasing our challenges. You know, we're going to push for an audit of the State Water Board. They've got to be held accountable. And quite frankly, I think the board members on there need to be held accountable. No agency in this state is increasing fees the way that State Water Board is without any challenges. They don't ever challenge the staff to go back and look at, hey, are there ways you can save money? Can you cut back on the reporting? How can we get what we need without, you know, bankrupting these people? And yet they just don't ask those questions. They just say, hey, that's what the increase is, and go on. Quite frankly, I had one of the board members last year tell me they're tired of hearing it. Well, we're tired of paying these fees without any accountability. And so we're going to up the ante this year.
The American Farm Bureau Federation and Farm Credit are hosting the 2025 Farm Bureau Ag Innovation Challenge. The competition aims to spotlight innovative solutions for issues facing farmers, ranchers, and rural communities. Entrepreneurs are invited to submit their ideas by June 15th. The overall winner receives $100,000, with $25,000 for the runner-up and $10,000 for two additional finalists. A total of $145,000 in startup funds is offered through the competition. 10 semifinalists will be chosen by September 3rd to pitch virtually for a spot in the final four. Finalists compete for additional prizes at the AFBF convention in January 2025. Eligible applicants must be Farm Bureau members, though non-members can join. More information on the Farm Bureau Ag Innovation Challenge is available at fb.org/challenge. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
10 years of USDA climate hubs. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
We need to be better equipped to mitigate the consequences of adverse weather patterns and to be able to adapt accordingly.
With those words recorded 10 years ago, February of 2014, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced the creation of 10 so-called regional climate hubs across the country. And he said farmers need to be given the information and the tools to help them adapt to climate change and hopefully reverse it.
You can't do that unless you have science-based, practical information and technologies that can be adopted in the field. And that's what these hubs will be designed to create and identify.
Today, the hubs form a network of over 120 climate researchers gathering and distributing information to help U.S. producers handle climate change. Also in May of last year, Vilsack announced the creation of an international climate hub. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Have you ever taken some offbeat advice to help your lawn or trees that turned out to be a disaster? Well, you're not alone. On this edition of Agriculture USA, Gary Crawford has some crazy stories for us from the Lawn and Garden Twilight Zone.
For those of us who love doing lawn and garden work, this is one of our favorite times of the year.
I think the loveliest time of the year is the spring, don't you?
I do, yes. And it's a good time for the nation's extension lawn and garden experts, too. But it's also that time of year when they start to come out of the woodwork, and we're not talking about termites, right? I hope you're curious now and that you do like a little oddness in your life and maybe a few laughs, because that is what we hope you're going to get on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford.
When you are an expert whose job it is to handle questions from the public, to try to figure out their problems and fix them, well, you may sometimes run into some questions or problems or suggestions that seem just a bit...
Crazy.
And a lot of times they get these crazy recommendations from their neighbors.
That does not mean that the people themselves are crazy, just that it might seem that way. This from Kansas State University Extension Lawn and Garden expert Dennis Patton. He says sometimes problems are caused by taking the neighbor's yard and garden advice.
The average person gets their lawn and garden advice. It's from their neighbor. And I jokingly tell people, you know, I've talked to your neighbor before. And trust me, you don't want to get your advice from them because I know the crazy things they've asked.
For example?
We get the home remedies from time to time.
Got milk?
You know, milk seems to be a salvation for everything for some reason. Spraying it on, I've heard that one.
Oh yes, milk as weed killer, fertilizer, insect controller should make the dairy producers very happy, except Patton says there's no truth in it. Of course, there are folks who don't use milk to kill weeds. Here's a story about a guy who is much too sophisticated for that. However...
The wife called our office, and the husband went out to do weed control. Husband didn't read the label. Husband sprayed the non-selective herbicide all over the lawn. And just killed out, from her description, about 3/4 of it. You just see the trails where he took the little wand and just had this trail throughout the lawn where he killed it all out with not reading the label, didn't understand some herbicides work differently. Let me just say she was not happy with her husband.
Well, to keep this even as far as gender goes, though, this next one is a hot one, and we do mean hot.
We have an insect called fall webworm, which these webs get all over the end of the branches of the tree. So this call, I had a call from a woman, her tree wasn't leafing out this year. And we went through everything under the face of the earth trying to figure out why this tree wasn't leafing out. And then finally she goes, well, you know, last fall I had these fall webworms, so I took a torch and burned them out of the tree. Do you think that would have killed the tree? Bingo.
Tree go, too, unfortunately. You remember what Smokey Bear used to say?
Only you can prevent forest fires.
But Dennis Patton's version is...
Trees and fire just don't go together.
Ah, but wait, there's more. Here's one from a 1980 interview I did with Deborah Smith, at that time an extension agent in Virginia. One day, this guy comes into her office frantic. Oh, and he says, please, please, Deborah, our hybrid poplar trees. They're dying. They're losing their leaves. You gotta save them. So he goes, Deborah sends off the sample he brought in to the university for a diagnosis.
The next day, his wife came in with another branch sample, and she was very agitated as well. I've got to know the answer by the weekend. I'll tell you the reason why. We planted these hybrid poplars as a living fence around our property. Very thick fence and screen from our neighbors. She said, we're having a hot tub party this weekend, and we're nudists. We need those trees as a screen. If the leaves keep falling off like this, the neighbors will start to complain.
Or maybe they won't. But anyway, they fixed it and everybody was happy. So next, we've got a brand new story from Kansas State University horticultural expert Ward Upham. He says there used to be a guy around his town who did some horticultural work.
Every once in a while, he'll do some tree planting for people. And this guy hired him, and he took him down to a neighbor that was down the street and said, I want a tree exactly like that. He said, okay. And so a week later, he had a tree that looked exactly like his neighbor's. When he drove past his neighbor's, his tree was missing.
Oh, wow. He dug it up in one place and moved it to him.
Yes. Yep.
Is this guy still running around free?
No, that was years and years ago.
Well, let's hope so anyway. That's all the time we have for today, thank goodness. You have been half listening, at least, to Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The U.S. Trade Representative recently provided updates and examples of how agricultural export opportunities are being developed and expanded for our nation's food and farm products. Rod Bain reports.
Recent visits with lawmakers allowed U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai opportunity to discuss our nation's continued efforts to expand farm and food export markets. She starts with efforts being made within the framework of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement.
Separately, through the USMCA, we are actively championing the interests of our farmers and agricultural producers. We have pursued two cases now against Canada's dairy tariff rate quota allocation measures, and we are currently in the midst of challenging Mexico's restrictive measures on biotech corn before a panel. We are actively pursuing litigation with Mexico using the tools of the USMCA precisely to address what we consider to be an illegitimate and unscientifically based restriction on our trade in biotech corn to Mexico.
Ambassador Tai also acknowledged the importance of building rural economies through increased ag trade opportunities.
Through negotiations, our administration has secured over $21 billion in new agricultural market access in the last 3 years,
such as increased farm and food exports in markets like India through negotiated tariff eliminations and reductions.
After the U.S. and India terminated 7 disputes at the WTO last year, India also agreed to remove retaliatory tariffs on several U.S. products. This means improved access for chickpeas, lentils, almonds, walnuts, and apples, benefiting farmers across the country, including Michigan, Oregon, California, and Washington. This means more market access for turkey, duck, blueberries, and cranberries, benefiting our farmers in North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Massachusetts, and Minnesota.
She also sees the importance of trade-building programs, such as USDA's Regional Agricultural Promotion Program, as a means to grow ag export opportunities in developing nations.
It is about sharing with the rest of the world the bounty that our incredibly hardworking and savvy farmers produce, and also diversifying our relationships with the markets around the world.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows, or if you just want to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. Just search for the AgNet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. For today's featured interview, I'm talking with Allison Jordan, Vice President of Environmental Affairs of the Wine Institute and Executive Director of the California Sustainable Wine Growing Alliance. We want to talk about sustainable wine growing. Tell me a little bit about why this is the perfect time to be talking about this.
Sure. April is Down to Earth Month, which is a time that we celebrate California's global leadership in sustainability. And we have dozens of wine events statewide, from eco-focused vineyard tours to wine tastings and festivals. We also have some climate-friendly recipes and wine pairings. All of these things can be found on discovercaliforniawines.com.
Tell me a little bit about what sustainability means in the wine grape or in the wine business.
Sure. So sustainable wine growing is all about making the highest quality grapes and wine while also protecting the environment, being a good neighbor and employer, and also maintaining thriving family farms and businesses. We have a lot of different educational tools and resources available, but also certification that really helps validate and verify that sustainable practices are being implemented.
What does it take to get that verification?
So basically, there are a set of practices that need to be adopted, and they're in areas like water use efficiency and energy efficiency, responsible pest management, soil health, waste management, being able to recycle and reuse and reduce, of course. Also thinking about the broader ecosystem and wildlife habitat, neighbors and community, being a good employer. And then we're also looking at things like how you contribute to the community. So whether it's through volunteerism or contributions, and looking also at your broader supply chain. So not just what you do within your vineyard or winery, but also through the supply chain. We have third-party auditors that basically are verifying that those practices are being adopted. We have requirements around measuring and tracking performance for water, energy use, greenhouse gas emissions. And then also, in addition to meeting the stringent requirements, the vineyards and wineries that are certified need to be really looking at their own operations and prioritizing and having action plans for making ongoing improvements. And all of these things are verified on an annual basis by a third-party auditor.
And then there were some awards that were given out recently, from what I understand. Can you tell us about them?
Sure. So during Down to Earth Month, the month of April, we also celebrate the California Green Medal Awards. It's really a way to recognize and share stories about leaders in sustainability in our industry. And they're doing a lot of things in terms of sustainable practices, but also innovating and sharing information. We have a very comprehensive judging process that looks at both sustainable viticulture and winemaking. And this year, it's actually our 10th anniversary. So we've over the past decade, we've been able to recognize close to 40 exemplary wineries and vineyards for really remarkable projects and an initiative that demonstrate this leadership that we have as a whole. In fact, in California, 80% of California wine is made in a certified sustainable winery, and well over half of our acreage, or over 60% of our acreage now is certified sustainable. But these awards help us really bring those stories to life and to really help illustrate what sustainability means.
Yeah, that's, it's kind of, I don't know, I just think it's amazing that these awards are available, that the verification is available, and that the wine industry, to hear that number, 85% of, the California wine, being sustainable like that, I think is amazing. What do you think it is that makes our state's wine grape growers so aware of this?
I think it really comes down, and there's thousands of growers and vintners in the state, but still so many of them are family-owned. And there's this idea of wanting to pass on your farm and your business to future generations. And so I think that's really at the foundation. Of course, there's a very ethic in California as a state and in our regulations, but then it goes beyond to people wanting to go above and beyond. And there is this idea that we're part very much tied to natural resources, being in agriculture, but also as part of a community where we have to be able to demonstrate that we are truly good environmental and community stewards. One other piece of it, I think, is, when you think about sustainability, a lot of it does come down to really trying to minimize your impact, and that can mean being increasingly efficient. And so there can also be benefits to the wineries and vineyards themselves in terms of reducing inputs and the related costs associated with them.
Do you think that there are things that other states can learn from the efforts that, the folks around California have put in?
Absolutely. And part of what we view as being a leader in sustainable wine growing is really sharing everything. So we make all of our information publicly available. In fact, we're having our third US Sustainable Wine Growing Summit coming up at the end of the month in April 30th and May 1st. And so it's really our way of trying to bring everyone together and making sure that we're leveraging knowledge and information and what we're learning about certification. We also see that a number of different programs around the US, but also internationally, have really used California as a model, and not only in wine growing, but in other agricultural sectors. So, for instance, California Almonds has developed a sustainability program, as has Cut Flowers and some other ag sectors, which is really exciting to see.
So tell me a little bit more about the event coming up at the end of the month.
We are partnering with California, New York, Oregon, and Washington wine organizations. Many of them have their own certification programs, but basically to bring together an amazing group of speakers, and we're going to be focusing on things like climate change and how we best can adapt to the changes that we can expect in wine regions around the US. We're also going to be focusing on our supply chain, how we can be more sustainable with all of our packaging and other aspects of things that we buy and use within the industry. And then we are focusing on diversity, equity, inclusion, and other social aspects of sustainability. And finally, one of the challenges with sustainability, you can tell it's so comprehensive. And so it can be a really difficult thing to be able to communicate to our stakeholders, to consumers and trade. And so we're also going to be focusing on how do we best tell those stories. And when people come to our vineyards and wineries, how can we really demonstrate the types of sustainable practices that we're talking about and that really are at the underpinning of our certification programs as well?
So if people are interested in this, where can they get more information?
There are a number of places. First of all, for information about Down to Earth Month, you can visit discovercaliforniawines.com. The green metal, the awards that we were talking a little bit about, this year you can learn about the leader, the business, the community, and the environment winners, along with all of the past winners, and that's at greenmetal.org. And then to learn more about sustainable wine growing and certification, a great website is californiasustainablewine.com, which is really focused on what's required for certification.
Kind of to wrap us up, is there anything else that you think that our listeners should know about or anything that we didn't touch on?
I think that it's great for everyone to realize that they can be part of the sustainability journey and to really applaud the wine growers and winemakers in California that are truly embracing sustainability. I think everyone always can learn more, and there's so many great ways to do that. Again, looking at this year's green medal winners from Land Twins and their leader award, Cooper Garrett, and their community award. We have Gloria Ferrer with the environment award and also Vino Farms with the business award. And they're just wonderful stories about families that are really trying to do the right thing for not only passing on a vibrant business to future generations for themselves, but really doing well by the community and also protecting our important natural resources.
Thank you once again to Allison Jordan, Vice President of the Environmental Affairs of the Wine Institute and Executive Director of the California Sustainable Wine Growing Alliance. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. USDA and the U.S. Agency for International Development are providing life-saving food aid to citizens in food insecure situations within 18 nations. Rod Main reports.
$1 billion, with a B, dollars in emergency food assistance to nations with populations needing life-saving food aid.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Agency for International Development will deploy Commodity Credit Corporation funding to purchase U.S.-grown commodities to provide emergency food assistance to people in need throughout the world.
Shane Danielson of USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service points to recent numbers regarding chronic hunger around the world as the catalyst behind the food aid package.
An estimated 205 million people need life-saving food assistance around the world, and some 768 million people are facing chronic hunger. These U.S. commodities will go a long way to strengthening global food security through the provision of nutritious U.S. global commodities.
The joint food aid effort takes a two-pronged approach.
An initial tranche of approximately $950 million will support the purchase, shipment, and distribution of various U.S. commodities, and a separate pilot project of up to $50 million will also eventually be set up to utilize U.S. commodities that have not traditionally been part of U.S. international food assistance programming, but that are shelf-stable and suitable for use in feeding food-insecure populations.
The breakdown of commodities included in the initial $950 million tranche of USDA USAID emergency food aid looks like this.
This initial tranche will support the purchase, shipment, and distribution of U.S. wheat, rice, sorghum, lentils, chickpeas, dry peas, vegetable oil, cornmeal, navy beans, pinto beans, and kidney beans.
18 nations across various parts of the globe are slated to receive this initial round of support.
A number of countries across the African continent. There are also countries included from the Caribbean, as well as the Middle East, and also into Asia.
The announcement of the emergency food aid package is a culmination of intentions announced by USDA last fall to purchase American-grown commodities and work with USAID to ensure those products would reach people around the globe in food insecure situations.
The notion was identifying populations that represent some of the most food insecure populations globally and that also complement other pre-existing programs that are administered both by USDA as well as by USAID. Our two organizations have come together to really work through the details of how to implement the strongest program possible that plays to the strength of both organizations as well as embraces the U.S. agricultural community in a way that will really create meaningful effect and impact for countries in need around the world.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West.
AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.